Time to get up. Gotta go meet the sun.
Peace and blessings. This is Michael Bernard Beckwith, the founder of the Agape International Spiritual Center, and the author of Spiritual Liberation, Fulfilling Your Soul's Potential. Welcome to the Sound of Transformation, where what we are about is waking up to the deep potential that's within every being on this planet so that we can become a strong and beneficial presence on the planet at this time in human history. In other words, we're not here just to become enlightened. We're here to become enlightened to fulfill our dynamic purpose at this time in our life. Week after week, we will have wonderful guests that are making a mighty difference on the planet, individuals who have embodied and activated the potential of their own soul and are going forward to inspire, uplift, and transform the planet according to their unique pattern and their unique gifts. Wake up to the sound of transformation. Peace and richest blessings to all of you. As you've heard, this is Michael Bernard Beckwith, and you've tuned in at the right time, right station, the right time in your life. But it's always the right time in your life to be open and receptive to inspiration, open and receptive to guidance, open and receptive to cultivating your ability to hear that still small voice that resides within you, beckoning you to make yourself available to remember who and what, where and why you are. The who of you as an emanation of the divine, the what, a greater expression of the divine, you at the very center of the universe, and why are you here? To perfectly express the cosmos in a way that has never happened before. And so you know you existed even before your parents were born as a nomina held in the mind of the universal presence, and we're here to activate those gifts and talents and express them fully and completely. And thus, allow for the planet to be better because we popped through. I welcome you to the sound of transformation. When we come back from this musical interlude, from the sound of agape, we will be with Lama Marut, the author of Be Nobody and other books as well. And we'll have a wonderful conversation. We'll be right back.
Turn within, and now
from within, we begin to see eternity from within. That's Ricky Byers Beckwith. That's from her CD, and that's the title track that she wrote, composed, and is singing, From Within. Today I have the honor of being in conversation with Lama Marut, a.k.a. Brian K. Smith, the son and grandson of Baptist ministers, extensively trained in the spiritual traditions of India and Tibetan Buddhism, holds a Ph.D. in comparative religion and taught for over 2 decades in the academic world, first at Columbia University and later at the University of California, where he retired as a professor emeritus in 2004. He lived as a Buddhist monk for 8 years and has served for the past 15 years as a spiritual teacher to students around the world. Lama Marut is currently the spiritual director of 8 Middleway centers located in Los Angeles, Cape Ann in Massachusetts, Nashville, Austin, Melbourne, Singapore, and Munich. In addition to several scholarly studies and translations based on Sanskrit materials, he's the author of the popular and award-winning book, A Spiritual Renegade's Guide to the Good Life. He recently published Be Nobody. In both books, he provides a step-by-step guidance on how to live a satisfying and rewarding life through the cultivation of virtues like forgiveness, gratitude, ethics, love, acceptance, and service to others. We all have the right and ability to be happy, and Lama Ru points the way to that goal by presenting the wisdom of ancient spiritual traditions in a current, up-to-date, and understandable manner, with this unique mixture of erudition and earthliness, intensity and humor, conviction and openness. His message is easily accessible and life-changing. Welcome to the show, Lama Ru.
Thanks, Michael. It's really great to be with you.
And it was good to see you at Agape the other day as well.
Oh, what an awesome experience. I recommend all your listeners come to Agape on Sunday mornings and get the spirit.
It was a great moment, and appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Yeah.
We're going to, first of all, introduce people to who you are.
Yeah.
And your early years, I guess you grew up as a Baptist.
Right.
You went from Baptism to Buddhism.
That's right. I was brought up in the church and kind of went into rebellion about that in my teenage years. And that kind of love-hate relationship with the Christian church, you know, has gone on for decades until I reconciled with it later in life. But I was hugely influenced in my own life, in my own spiritual understanding by the Christian tradition. And then I went into the academic world in the study of religion and concentrated on the religions of India and was very influenced by that. It was not only an intellectual kind of journey for me, but it kind of creeped in, you know, through the back door.
Right.
I thought it was all about the head, but something got into the heart, too. And then in the late 1990s, I had sort of a midlife crisis, as it were, and wanted to get serious about a real spiritual practice. And, you know, I turned to Tibetan Buddhism and studied that very thoroughly over the course of many, many years, eventually taking ordination as a Buddhist monk. And now it's kind of coming all together in a way. I don't really identify myself with any one particular tradition. I have, as I said, been shaped by at least 3 major world traditions. And so I'm kind of a spiritual hybrid, you
right.
know, like a mongrel. And try to see the truth of what they're all teaching, you know, and convey that to folks who may or may not want to identify with any particular religious ism or ology, you know, but want to live a good life, a good spiritual life.
Absolutely. That's why we often say at Agape that we are trans-denominational. We go beyond denomination into that which is truth to the best of our ability to understand and practice, and that truth that religions point to as a direct contact and direct experience. So we too seek not to wrap ourselves in such a small package of identifying with one thing, but other than the spiritual principles that govern the universe.
That's really beautiful. And in our day and age, we just live in a big world now, or you could say a small world. You know, the world has collapsed. We know about everybody now. We know each other. Communication is instant. And these old kind of boundaries, you know, are breaking down because of the kind of world community that we live in. We live in, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-religious cities. We have access to the World Wide Web. We know more about each other as human beings now than ever before. Maybe it's time to let go of the kind of boundaries that have separated us in the past and see what we share in common.
Absolutely. Letting go of that, this is the only way.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You mentioned in your book that when you were younger, you also visited an African-American church while growing up. And you said it was eye-opening to see people having fun there.
Well, that's right. I was a Baptist. We were primarily a white church, but we had relationship with a sister church, a black church in St. Paul, Minnesota. And when I went to the white church, you know, nobody's really having much fun. You know, it just seems like it was kind of a duty and a chore to struggle through the hour and a half, 2 hour service every Sunday morning. But then when we got to visit the sister church, we noticed that black folks are having fun at church, and that's the way it should be. And, you know, I was always wondering, well, how come white folks can't have fun at church?
One of your books is called The Spiritual Renegade's Guide to the Good Life, and you mentioned that this book is for desperados. What do you mean by that?
I think a serious spiritual life begins with a kind of a desperation, by which I mean a kind of realization that the non-spiritual life, the purely secular life, is a dead end and doesn't lead to the happiness and deep seated satisfaction and contentment that people are looking for in life. And so I think it's very, very crucial in a way, if you're going to really get serious about a spiritual life, to have a good kind of wake-up call.
Right.
And, of course, life provides all kinds of them for us, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The midlife crisis is, like, perfectly set up for us to wake up.
Yeah. So never let a good disaster go to waste.
Right.
When the poo-poo hits the fan, you know, this is an opportunity for us to see, well, what really is important in life and what really will pay off for us in our search for true fulfillment in life. So that's the desperado part, feeling a good sort of healthy sense of desperation with the alternatives to a spiritual life. And then you get serious, I think, about really pursuing that a different way of living and a different way of pursuing your goals.
Right. You mentioned the word happiness, and you teach that happiness is not a choice, that it's hardwired into our nature.
Well, that's right. From the moment we wake up to the time we go to bed, we're all just trying to be happy. Pretty much everything we do is trying to make us happy and avoid pain. That's just fundamental to our nature.
Right.
The problem is number one, we don't understand what happiness is.
Mm-hmm.
We mistake pleasure for happiness.
Absolutely.
Which is a big problem because you can't maintain it. You can't just have pleasure all the time.
Right. You can't have the icing all the time. You got to have some real food.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, we don't understand the methods for achieving the goal of true happiness. So we pursue it in all kinds of ways. You know, we try to make money. We try to advance at the job. We try to maximize our relationships, you know, and hope that other people will make us happy somehow and don't take responsibility for it in our own lives and don't realize that the happiness that we really are seeking is not a matter of sensual pleasures. But it's mental, it's spiritual, it's inside of us.
Because the pleasure is just one pole, of the other side is pain. And
they
so
have to put together, don't they, Michael?
Yeah, you know, you have one, you got to have the other. But happiness and real joy are spiritual qualities.
That's right.
That when we touch them, they become active within us. And after a while, through, as you're speaking about this here, spiritual practice, they become unconditional. They're not based on even conditions in our life.
That's right. And so then, you know, no matter what vicissitudes you're undergoing in life, you know, you can keep a steady, even keel because of the deep resources that you found within yourself.
Absolutely. So you speak about individuals who are resistant to being happy. And you also speak about the fact that if you're not practicing your spirituality properly, you're not getting happier. You know, there's a correspondent there.
Well, that's right. I mean, human beings are kind of messed up. You know what I mean? We want to be happy, but at the same time, we resist both the goal and the methods for achieving the goal. So we're at war with ourselves, a little angel and devil inside of each one of us at war. And it is our right to be happy. It is our birthright to be happy. And nobody has more or less that right than anyone else. And so, you know, that's one, to just recognize that this is what we want and this is what we should have, deep-seated contentment and happiness with life. And then we turn to our spiritual methods, and sometimes we find that because we don't understand them properly, we haven't been taught them properly, that they turn into just another way to feel unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we can feel guilty because we're such bad people, because we've been told that we're sort of intrinsically bad, and so, you know, have that whole guilt trip going on. Or we can use our spiritual communities as ways to divide ourselves off from other people instead of bringing us together. This is the nature of religious warfare, both at the largest levels and even in sort of micro versions of it, where we identify with one or another religious tradition, spiritual tradition, and then say, and that makes me better than other people, or that separates me off from people who don't hold that particular identity card.
Absolutely. And continuing that same vibe, you teach that we are the sole architects of our own suffering. And so it is that we can be our own saviors, since we are our own soul architects.
Well, as Reverend Beckwith says, you got to lose the victim card and replace it with the victorious card.
Right.
That means taking responsibility for yourself, first and foremost. It's no one else's fault that you're unhappy, and it's no one else's responsibility to make you happy than yourself.
Right there. That's the key. It's nobody else's fault and no one else's responsibility.
You know, that's a great empowerment. But at the same time, you know, with power comes responsibility. So end the blame game and start taking responsibility for your own happiness and your own unhappiness, and then you're really on the right track. You know, if you think that somebody else has it in their power to make you unhappy, or that somebody else has the responsibility to make you happy, then you're always dependent on something outside of you. And it's a losing game. Other people can't fulfill those functions because they don't have the power to make you happy.
Yeah,
they don't really have the power to make you unhappy either.
7 billion people on the planet, and people are believing that there's somebody out there that has their answer. They're going to be searching forever, and they have the answer and the key within themselves.
That would be nice. I mean, it's sort of a lazy man's way, a lazy woman's way to approach a spiritual life is waiting for the fairy godmother or godfather to come and wave their magic wand over your head, and kabam. Now you're fixed, now you're happy, and now you're satisfied.
And you had no level of participation in your own unfolding.
Right, exactly.
If you guys are just tuning in to Wake Up the Sound of Transformation, I'm in conversation with Lama Marut. He is the author of the popular award-winning book, A Spiritual Renegade's Guide to the Good Life, and he recently wrote and published Be a Nobody. So let's jump into that for a moment and talk to us about the meaning behind the title of the book, Be Nobody.
Well, it's obviously meant to be a little provocative, you know. When you hear be nobody, I think if you're like me, the first thing that comes to mind is, what do you mean be nobody? I want to be somebody. I am somebody.
And, right.
You know, I want to be somebody more even. You know, the whole point is to be a bigger and bigger somebody or something like that. And, you know, we all are somebody. We're born somebody. We're born individuals, little unique snowflakes. We come with our own genetic makeup and our own personality, really. Babies have personalities. And then, as life unfolds and we have our various experiences, personal experiences, we become more and more individualized. We become more and more uniquer. So we're already that way. We're already somebody. And we should have a good, healthy affirmation of that, of our uniqueness. That's important. But at the same time, an overemphasis on the individual, on the snowflake self, on the somebody self, can blind us to our commonalities, deeper commonalities. So we can talk about a number of them, but one of them is that, you know, we're all having a hard time. We all suffer. We all have problems in life. And, you know, when you have a problem in life, well, that's not because God singled you out or that Mr. Karma or Ms. Karma decided to get on your case.
You personally.
You know, this is life. We all have difficulties, and we all are equal in that. Nobody's difficulties are intrinsically more difficult than anyone else's. Suffering is a subjective experience, not an objective thing that you can measure. So we're all alike in that, and we're all alike in that we want to be happy. Everyone wants to be happy in the ways that we talked about earlier. And we're also all alike in that we have the potential equally to do that. And that potential is what I'm pointing at when I say be nobody.
Right. You're saying nobody is really our real nature in being.
That's right.
Which is not any sense of separation from life or being boldly special than anybody else, but it's actually our innate nature.
That's right. And we get in touch with it with some regularity, and it's when we are happiest. It is when we drop our somebody self, when we have that little voice inside of us shut up already and integrate with life, with experience, with another person, with the whole, with the greatest whole. You know, we have this experience in even very mundane kinds of things, like getting absorbed in a good book or getting absorbed in a good movie or listening to a beautiful piece of music and just totally integrating with the beauty of the sound. And where are we then? You know, who are we then?
Nobody. You're in flow.
Yeah.
At that moment.
Flow. Exactly. That's right. What the psychologists call it nowadays, being right. In the flow.
Right.
So I use the phrase in the book, mindful unselfconsciousness.
Yeah, I like that. Mindful unselfconsciousness.
Mindful, because you're mindful, you know, especially if you lose yourself in an activity, you know, like a good hobby. People have hobbies and they love their hobbies because they don't have to be themselves. They can lose themselves in the activity. But, you know, you got to be mindful. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to be skilled at it. And this is the way, of course, in life in general.
Yeah.
But unselfconsciously. And then you're integrated with the experience. You're integrated with life, and you're integrated with the people around you, you know, and even the larger cosmos. When we cease to be somebody, we are nobody, which gives us the opportunity to feel like everybody.
Absolutely. What I love what you're saying underneath is that you're not asking people to be airy-fairy or have a spiritual lobotomy. You're talking about a level of mindfulness where there's discernment. There's awareness, and at the same time, you're not attached to your littleness, or you're not attached to the ego, you're not attached to that sense of separation that leads to fear and doubt and worry. So you're mindful, you're awake, you're aware, and you're fully participating in life.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think a lot of people have a complete misunderstanding of religion. People assume, especially sort of atheists and so forth, assume that religion is about a dream, a fantasy, you know, going to the good old by and by and, you know. My understanding of religion is that religion is integrating with reality.
Yes.
It is waking up from a dream, waking up from illusion, waking up from delusion, and seeing things as they really are. And we are already connected. We are already interconnected with everything and everybody, but we don't recognize that. We feel alone, we feel isolated, because we're grasping onto the illusion of an independent self, an atomistically independent self that is separate from everything and everybody else. And that is an illusion.
Absolutely. Remember that old story about the head monk is laying down prostrate saying, I'm nobody, I'm nobody. And then his student follows him and starts doing the same thing every day. I'm nobody, I'm nobody. And finally, one of the novices begin to join in. I'm nobody, I'm nobody. And the second monk looks at the teacher and says, look who thinks they're nobody.
I could see it coming a mile away. That was it. Yeah, of course. And, you know, this is another aspect. I want to clear up any misunderstanding about the phrase, because we can feel like a real nobody. You know, we can have this sort of sense of low self-esteem. And that's not being nobody.
Absolutely.
That's being somebody as a nobody.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
People identifying with their depression, identifying with their low self-esteem. You know, if you can't feel good enough in a positive way, then you try to stake your claim as a special somebody in a negative way.
Right. The ego doesn't care whether you're puffing yourself up or putting yourself down. It's just still getting the same special attention.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, low self-esteem and depression are a pandemic nowadays. It's a huge problem in our world. We need to address it. We need to address what are the real causes of that and what are the real cures for feeling true self-esteem, deep self-esteem. And that's getting in touch with that universal, cosmic, true self that we all have and we all have equally.
Right. You actually pose that question in your book. You say, is it just coincidental that with the narcissism and the self-obsession so enshrined in our society, we're simultaneously witnessing an equally breathtaking increase in the rate of mental illness?
Well, yeah. And, you know, I suffered from depression. I was hospitalized for depression. I know what depression is. And it's a very, very terrible thing, that dark cloud that just engulfs you. And so I'm in no way trivializing the suffering that people endure in depression. But if you take a little pan out, you know, into a more cultural level instead of an individual level, it does seem to be the case that there is a paralleling rise on the one hand of obsession with the self, narcissism, self-concern, neediness, and all of that of the self on the one hand. And on the other hand, this rise of depression. And, you know, what goes up must come down. The spiritual traditions have told us that with the increase in pride, culturally and individually, the increase of pride and self-centeredness, there is the concomitant karmic tendency for there to be a crash.
Right. That's why the great teacher, I believe, said, if you try to save your little life, you know, that somebody life, you'll lose it. But if you lose it for my sake, for the sake of reality, then you're able to touch life eternal.
Yeah.
It's the same type of vibration.
That sounds like Jesus talking.
That's him. Yeshua ben Joseph, Jesus the Christ. So then on the opposite end of self-obsession, there lives humility. And you state that it's important that we do not mistake humility for self-abasement or confuse depression with self-forgetfulness. You see, I think that's very important as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Humility has always been a virtue taught by our great spiritual teachers of the past. Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. You know, he was willing to do that, to show his humility, which is not abasement. It's not self-abasement. It's recognizing, number one, that you're strong enough as an individual to serve other people.
Yes.
And not just have it all be about you all the time. You know?
Right.
So it's to come from that place of deep self-acceptance and feeling like, well, I'm okay, you know. What about you? You see, I'm okay now. What about you? And then secondly, to recognize that when you serve other people, you're serving yourself. To have a re-identification of who you are and not just be clinging to the ego and to the individual as yourself or even as your deepest self, but recognizing that we are really connected, that we all are in some sense the same and the same self.
Right.
And then when you serve others, you are serving yourself because you are the other. Or you could say there are no others.
Right. You have an insight that breaks down that barrier, that filter, and you do see that that other being is a you.
Yes.
And again, one of Jesus' powerful statements is, you know, the greatest among you is the servant.
Yeah.
Not servitude, but real service to one another.
The last shall be first, and the first shall be last.
Absolutely. So we're going to take our musical break at this time. We're listening and talking with Lama Marut. He's the author of Be Nobody. He says we're all desperately trying to be somebody. Maybe we've got it all wrong. Be Nobody by Lama Marut. We'll be right back.
I'm better than I have been.
Radiant Faith. That's track number 8 on the CD entitled The Land of I Am. That's Ricky Byers Beckwith singing. We wrote that song, Radiant Faith, on the highway, on the desert for our Lord. The highway is almost like no thingness and no bodiness. There's nothing there in the desert. So you're available to insights and revelations. A Radiant Faith, very powerful. We're back with Lama Marut, author of Be Nobody. Welcome back, my brother.
Thank you, Michael.
In part 2 of your book, you offer that the key to true self-improvement is, first of all, the development of a better self-conception. I want you to get into that a little bit, and then what constitutes real self-help?
Yeah, thanks. We all want to improve ourselves, and it's important to improve ourselves. But, you know, we have to, first of all, recognize who the self is that we're trying to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And the self is not a thing. The personality, the individual self, now
right.
I'm talking about here.
Right.
The individual self is not a thing. It's not an entity. It's not findable as something when you go looking for it. And Buddhist texts have been saying this for 2,500 years, and now our neuroscientists are kind of discovering the same thing, that when you go looking for the essential self, the individual essential self, it's just not there. What we call the self is a bundle of functions. You know, it's mental functions, physical functions, bundle of parts. And then we overlay a name on it. I am Marut. I am Michael. I am this. I am that. And so you could say the self is just an idea of the self. The self is much more accurate to say that we have a self-conception
yes.
than it is that we have a self. And then the next question is, well, then why do I have the self-conception that I do? Why do I have the particular self-conception that I have? And that's because of our memories. You know, we are who we think we once were. And you could put another name on that and call it karma. That's what karma is, our memories.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
the process of self-improvement is to revise memory and to implant, start to create, to gift yourself with better memories for the future, because you will be who you are now.
Moment by moment, bite-sized pieces.
So how do we improve our self-conception? Well, we start living a good life. We start living a life of ethics, of kindness, of non-harmfulness to other people, which implants memories that improve our conception. Oh, I remember, you know, last week I tried to forbear in retaliating when someone was aggravating to me. You know, you remember the good things, of course the bad things too. So that's the whole point of karma, really, is to gift yourself with better memories because of the way that you've acted, the way you've spoken, and even the way you've thought. And that's real self-improvement. That's how you improve the self, improve the self-conception.
And after a while, you have kind of a karma credit because your memories about your seeking to be better or seeking to serve or seeking to discover your real nature and being start to outweigh the memories of mistakes or misgivings or lack of self-esteem or whatever, self-loathing. And so you just start to develop what we call a karma credit.
Yeah.
That vibration creates a little momentum.
Yeah.
Actually.
And it's true. We all do make mistakes. And, you know, it's important also to own that a little bit, at least a little bit, and to say, you know, I'm a human being, just like every other human being. I have made mistakes, and I regret them. Have some good, healthy regret, which isn't guilt.
Right. Absolutely. That is so true. Riff on that, because I love talking about the fact that it's not the same. Guilt and regret are not the same.
Quite different. Regret is always meant to sort of activate you, to inspire you to not make that same mistake again. Guilt is just useless. Guilt is just another way to think about you and how important you are, kind of in the negative way.
Right, the ego is holding you captive.
So the image that I've heard that's very, very useful, I think, for me at least, is that it's like if you had taken a sip of water from a glass and then somebody said, you know, there was arsenic in that water. You wouldn't feel guilt about it. Oh, I'm such a bad person. I drank arsenic, you know. But you'd feel
you definitely regret it.
And if you survived it, you'd say, well, you know, I'm going to be damn sure I'm not going to drink arsenic again water. You know what I mean?
Check out my water supply.
Yeah. So it is important. And we can change our past memories. Even memories of things that we've done in the past can be redeemed.
Yes.
Through, you know, virtues like forgiveness, including forgiveness of ourselves. And gratitude and acceptance, these are all ways of retroactively improving your memories.
Right.
And then, of course, looking forward, well, you know, how should I live today in such a way that I will look back on me later with acceptance and pride, good pride.
Yeah, not immature pride, yes.
Instead of with regret.
I appreciate what you're saying. It seems as though when we're able to look back and redeem those thoughts, our perception expands and we're able to see even the past from a different angle. And we see that what we were experiencing was not really reality. It was more our thoughts about what was going on.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I always remember a young lady that came to see me, and she's very brilliant, great writer, great artist. But she would always get to a point in her life where she would sabotage the great thing that was about to happen in her life. And she always felt that nobody was there for her. The universe wasn't on her side. She had these feelings, these emotions. And so I worked with her for a bit. And I had another spiritual practitioner who was also a hypnotherapist. And she regressed her and discovered that when she was a little girl, she had been left alone. She'd been abused. And in her perception of that reality, she was alone and wasn't loved. But when she regressed, she discovered that during the times when she was most alone, there were these tremendous beings around her, the invisible, and that this presence was very, very with her. And when she came out of that particular regression, she had the feeling tone that she was never alone. She was always loved. So it didn't change what happened, but it changed her perception of what was happening.
Yeah, that's right.
And she was able to walk forward with the memory of, I've never been alone, and I've always been supported by a friendly universe.
Yeah.
It totally changed her future.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story, Michael.
So earlier you were speaking about, and I really want people to catch this, you were speaking about our great degree of happiness is when we lose ourselves and we move into what you're calling mindful unselfconsciousness. And I love the way you talked about that. I think we may be talking about the freedom also to play. And oftentimes I talk about that the vibration of prayer and playing have the same frequency at times. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. Pure play, I'd say.
Yes, you know, not attachment to winning, but just playing.
Exactly. So it's not whether you win or lose, but how you play the game. You know, this has unfortunately been kind of replaced by football coach Vince Lombardi's statement, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing.
Right.
And complete perversion of play. So when we think about play, we have to kind of recover what it's like for a child, you know, at play. And a child is very, very energetic. If you watch kids on the playground, you know, they'll just be sliding and swinging and teeter-totting and running around for hours on end.
You know what? I did the teeter-totter yesterday.
Did you?
We had a staff meeting. We had the staff meeting at the park. And, you know, had moments of prayer. We honored each other and shared some things. And I happened to see two of my staff members over in the park on the teeter-totter. And I had one of them get off so I could get on.
Hey, good for you, Michael. Good for you.
Oh, you know, it was a fun moment. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you said teeter-totter and my mind went right there.
And, you know, you see, the point of pure play is that it's not goal-oriented. It's action for its own sake, purely. You know, there's no purpose or end in sight. You know, if you went to ask a child, why are you swinging, little girl? You know, what's the point of that swinging? What's the point of that climbing up the slide and sliding down and then climbing up the slide? What are you trying to achieve by that? You know, they look at you like you're crazy because it's a crazy question. The joy is in the doing.
Yes.
It's not like I'm sliding to have slid. I'm sliding because the sliding is fun. And this
right.
is pointing us to a beautiful way of thinking about life in general.
Right.
Of living life fully in the moment without overemphasis on what I'm going to get out of it or what the goal is, but to be fully in the moment and to live life as if it were play or as if it were artistic expression.
Yes.
Because, you know, like we play and listen to music, we dance, not for a purpose. There's no
right.
reason to do that. There's
I mean, they messed that up. Now they have dance contests on TV and things like that.
Yeah,
but dance in its pure form and singing in its pure form is just the expression of God, not Taraj. It's just the expression of the presence.
That's right. It's what the Indian traditions call Leela.
Leela.
L-I-L-A. You know,
right.
it's just divine play. The gods at play. And so we can replicate the gods by playing through life and not taking it all so damn seriously, really. It's important to take certain things in life seriously, but to take ourselves too seriously and to take this relatively short time we have on this planet overly seriously kind of precludes the fun element of life and the joyousness of living.
Yeah, people ask me about that. Why aren't you serious? I say, you know, there's nothing serious going on in the universe. There's no one being born. No one's dying. You know, it's all a play of consciousness. So I say I take life reverentially, but not seriously.
Oh, that's good.
So
I like that.
Have a reverent love for nature and Mother Nature and the oceans and the rainforest and people. But I don't take it seriously, but I take it reverentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So if you're just tuning in, the last portion, you're listening to Lama Marut, who's currently the spiritual director of 8 middleway centers located around the world. And the author of Be Nobody, the latest offering is to Be Nobody. Many of you may have heard about his award-winning book, A Spiritual Renegade's Guide to the Good Life. And so that's the other voice you're hearing on the program with me today. This conversation is reminding me of, remember the movie that came out many years ago, Chariots of Fire, about those two runners?
Yeah.
And one was running really intensely to win, and the other just loved to run. And they were both fast, but they approached it totally different.
Yeah.
One
yeah.
just threw his head back and just loved running, and one had to win it.
Yeah.
And it showed what we're talking about here, the two dynamics of how one approaches life.
And, you know, I think if we investigate our own experience, we actually perform optimally when we are fully in the moment, fully in the experience, without thinking about the goal, without thinking about what we're going to get out of it. It's then that we can really fully engage in whatever it is that we're doing. So it's a much more efficient way of living as well.
I like that. It's fully engaged, full participation, but without attachment to an outcome.
Yeah, that's right.
So the outcome can form itself based on our engagement, and most of the time, the outcome is better than what we can make happen.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Yeah, life surprises us with its infinite varieties of how it can bless us through its grace.
It's kind of a good thing that we're not in absolute control of our own lives, because we'd make a mess of it.
Oh, my God. Or if we could influence the mind of the universe or the mind of God,
right.
We'd be in trouble.
Like what we think we should have and all of that. We're rewarded much, much better than we could ever have imagined.
I'm reminded of the statement, hell is God giving an individual exactly what they want.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So this brings up something else that you wrote in your book, Be Nobody. Around the same kind of vibrations, you wrote that liberation from anxiety of always feeling that you have to be somebody is found only in true selflessness and freedom from ego's restrictions, where solace is found in relaxing into life rather than endlessly micromanage it for one's own selfish needs.
Yeah.
Micromanaging.
I mean, of course, we do what we can to live a good life and to improve ourselves and so forth, but how things will turn out is really unknowable to us. You know, sometimes people get the idea that they can work their will on the world in one way or another, you know, with secular tools like money and power and all of that. But then people come to the spiritual life and think, well, I'm going to work my will on the world with karma or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, if you investigate the deeper teachings on karma, karma is defined, good karma is defined as, how selfless can it be in your intention, you see?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How selfless can you be in your intention? And the more selfless, the greater the karma, the more powerful the good karma. So we let go. We let go of what am I going to get out of the deal here? And do it for others. Do it for the larger whole. Do it selflessly. And then all rewards come. Rewards, like we were just saying, that you couldn't even begin to imagine for yourself will come effortlessly, but not because you sit around wanting them. You know what I mean?
Right. That's an immature wanting. There's a mature wanting, but there's an immature wanting. And people are bombarded every single day by the weapon of mass distraction called our media to have them want things that they don't need. 15 minutes of fame and things. And they end up resisting life and resisting their own happiness by the immature wanting.
Yeah, that's right. We are living in a time where a person who's really interested in living a good life, a happy life, has really got to fight the power, because the power is amassed against that. The power of consumerism, the power of greed, the power of narcissism and selfishness. And this is a major power that we live under culturally and economically and so forth.
I call it the overculture. And we put people who have ascended in the ranks of consumerism and materialism on the front of magazines.
That's right.
You know, as heroes.
Yeah.
And many of these people die with way more money in their bank accounts than they could have spent in 3 or 4 lifetimes.
Okay.
And they think they won, but they actually lost because they didn't circulate it for the benefit of expression of compassion or kindness or even making the world a little better.
Yeah, that's right.
They actually have lost the game. Because
yeah.
The old rules were he or she who gets the most gold wins. And now we know that he or she who circulates the most, shares the most, gives the most, is actually the winner.
That's right. Well, you can't keep anything, right? Everything's impermanent, so you might as well sort of self-consciously circulate it. It's going to be taken away from you anyway.
Yeah, it's gone anyway. It's all temporary. You're going to end up causing enemies with your family when you leave.
Yeah.
I want that chair. I want that house. I want that money. He left that to me. And then you end up splitting families.
That's bad, huh? But I think, you know, people have lived under this ideology, you know, in our culture for over 50 years or so, 50, 60 years since post-World War II era. So we should wise up a little bit about this. The dead end of consumerism. Consumerism, at its heart and soul, has as its purpose to keep us constantly dissatisfied.
Absolutely.
So that we keep buying, keep greedily amassing wealth and things and experiences and pleasures and all of that. And there's no end to that. You'll never be satisfied trying to satisfy all your wants. You know what I mean?
Even our economic system is based on that kind of lack and scarcity, where you had a president saying, go out and shop to keep the economy going. You know,
exactly.
It's like one of the most unconscious and unconscionable things that a leader could say to the people is to go out and shop rather than go home and be with your family. Go home and have a moment with your family in meditation and prayer. Be of service. Volunteer somewhere. You know, do something creative. He said, go shop.
Amazing, isn't it? So tragic. You know, tragic, tragic thing like 9/11. And then the mask of what really mattered to the powers that be came off a little bit.
Right. It's like we want this economy that has a hole in it to stay afloat, but you've guys got to do your part. You've got to take your money that you don't have enough of and circulate it on something you don't need that's going to be in a landfill in less than 2 months to pollute the environment, to leak into the oceans and kill all the fish.
People were afraid to go to the shopping malls and so forth because of terrorist attacks. And then it was like, oh, my God, you know.
Don't let them block our way of living.
Exactly. Go shopping. So sad.
Very sad, and that's why we're here doing our little part, trying to wake people up. Now, the other thing, there is a sense of separation among people that seems to run rampant as the human condition. Now, we know this, it's an illusion that we're never really separate from each other on a subjective level, on a spiritual level. What can people do on a daily basis to see past the illusion, tap into the truth, and essentially access the happiness that comes from our real self?
Well, I think it doesn't have to be much. You don't have to make world-shaking changes or try to transform the universe single-handedly. But as we go through life, to just recognize that the people that we're encountering, who many times are quite different from ourselves, living different kinds of lives, different kinds of cultural backgrounds, etc., are just human beings just like us, no different at bottom, have the same wants, needs, desires, hopes, fears that we do, and that we all are in the same boat here. And to just have that recognition as you meet, you know, the checkout girl at the grocery store, or, you know, the guy at the dry cleaners, or, you know, whoever it is that you're encountering, they're just like you, just a human being just like you. And that's a very easy way to sort of emphasize more your ordinariness instead of your specialness.
Right, and then you become extraordinary.
Yeah. We're all just ordinary Joes and Josephines at bottom. And to drop that sort of sense of specialness, which increases the distinctions and the differences and establishes hierarchy between ourselves and others, and get down to that more basic, fundamental equality that we all have.
Yeah, I always say we're unique, but we're not special. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
So everybody wants to know how they can be a nobody. You have any final thoughts?
Well, you already are nobody. Everybody's always been nobody. The somebody self is like a wave that arises from the ocean. I'm watching the ocean right now.
And,
you know, individual waves, they rise up from the ocean, and then they last for a while, and they go back into the ocean. But we all are the ocean, and the individual waves is just the temporary expression of the ocean in motion. You see,
yes,
the ocean
yes.
in motion.
Yes.
Identify with the ocean. Have good, healthy self-respect for the wave. You know, the wave is you, and you're unique, and you're special, but you are also the ocean, and you will return to the ocean. And to identify with that cosmic whole, rather than get overly fixated on the particular individual that is the cosmic whole's expression. Right now.
I got it. This is beautiful. His book, Be Nobody, by Lama Marut, is just released. His website is lamamarut.org. And I imagine on your website they can find out more about you and where you're speaking and what you're doing and how they can get in contact with you.
Yeah, that's right.
Very good. So that's Lama Marut, lamamarut.org. The book is Be Nobody by Lama Marut. This has been great.
Great pleasure and a blessing to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Everyone, I want you to take in what we talked about today, that you don't have to try to be somebody. That your original face, your authentic nature, has never been born and will never die. You have the opportunity to discover this through your spiritual practices, to wake up to the sense of no bodiness. You're not your body, you're not your mind, you're not your emotional body. All of that is within your awareness, and through your diligent practice and availability, you find yourself more in flow with life rather than resisting life and happiness. Peace and blessings to all of you. Remember to go to agapelive.com to see what's going on in our spiritual center. And many of you will see you Sunday at one of the three services. Have a wonderful, bright, and magnificent day. Peace and richest blessings to you. Oh.